From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Bush is a West Texas sheriff, and he happens to be in the White House. And, you know, can you imagine sending the Army, Navy, and Marines after these bad guys in some foreign country where they can blow hundreds of square miles into smithereens and get higher polls back home? What do you do with the domestic anthrax people? What do you do? Who do you send?
Today, a Democracy Now! Interview with Ralph Nader about anthrax, Afghanistan, healthcare, and the corporate elite. But first, a look at Robert Mugabe's victory in Zimbabwe. We'll speak with the Zimbabwean ambassador to the United States and an opposition journalist in Harare. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Breaking the sound barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush suffered his first defeat on a judicial nomination Thursday when the Senate Judiciary Committee rejected his bid to elevate conservative Mississippi Judge Charles Pickering to a federal appeals court. Critics contended he could not be trusted on civil rights and has repeatedly put his own views above the law. They cited his having written when he was 21 an article recommending changes to strengthen Mississippi's law against racially mixed marriages. They also pointed to his defection from the Mississippi Democratic Party in 1964 when it was forced to integrate its national convention delegation. But after Judge Pickering's supporters countered with accounts of his efforts at racial reconciliation, critics emphasized his actions when he presided over a 1994 trial involving a cross-burning. Judge Pickering aggressively promoted his views to prosecutors that the sentence for the one defendant who was convicted at trial was too severe, even though it was mandated by law. In the end, he persuaded prosecutors to drop the charge that would have required the long sentence. Billed as a possible dress rehearsal for when Bush gets his first chance to make a nomination to the Supreme Court, the battle saw the president publicly reject the charges and telephoned senators early yesterday in a last-ditch effort. After the votes were in, Bush said in a statement he was deeply disappointed by the defeat. Israeli forces rolled out of Ramallah last night, 3 days after they reoccupied it in the biggest military offensive in the West Bank since 1967. But as the Bush administration's Middle East envoy arrived in the region, Israeli forces shot dead 2 Palestinians. Some 100,000 trade unionists filled the streets of Barcelona, Spain, calling for a social Europe in a protest called before this weekend's European Union summit at the capital. Heads of state and government from across the European Union will meet this weekend to discuss what they call economic and social reforms. Several thousand demonstrators marched behind a banner demanding full employment and social rights in the European Union. Trade unions are planning a series of huge demonstrations in the Catalan capital this weekend. Yugoslavia was officially declared dead Thursday as leaders from the two remaining republics agreed on a pointedly loose federation and a new name, Serbia and Montenegro. The pact must be approved by the parliaments of both nations before it takes effect. Meanwhile, at the International War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague, former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic is cross-examining the first Western politician from a NATO country to appear before the court, Britain's Lord Paddy Ashdown. He had served as a negotiator for the West on several missions to Yugoslavia throughout the 90s. We now go to Belgrade, where we're joined by journalist Liljana Smaljevic. She is a columnist for the leading Serbian magazine, NIN. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Liljana.
Hi.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about the significance of Milosevic cross-examining the first Western politician from a NATO country to appear before the court?
Well, we all expected a great deal from this testimony today because it was to show us what Milosevic would do to the other Western politicians if they were to show up in court at his request as witnesses for the defense. But today we had a chance to see how Milosevic does when he is faced with just as savvy a politician as himself. However, the impression I got, my strongest impression of the cross-examination so far, is that Lord Ashdown, as he is addressed in the Hague Court, is treated very differently by Judge May than any other witness so far. And in fact, you could easily have mistaken Lord Ashdown for the judge himself. He was the one who was determining what question. He was talking like the judge. He would say, I will answer this, but I will not answer that. He was saying to Milosevic, who may be the accused, but he is also, when he examines, a lawyer who's doing cross-examination. So he would say to Milosevic, your question is not relevant, which is something that usually the judge gets to do. And the reason this is becoming very obvious is that Judge May, who is also British, treats in a certain way the prosecutor, Mr. Jeffrey Nice, also British, but fails to show the same deference and sometimes even civility to other people in court. I will not just talk of the accused, Mr. Milosevic, at whom he sometimes yells, no, 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 with a sneer in his voice, but occasionally he also addresses that way Mr. Tapushkovic, who is a friend of the court, who was appointed by the court, but who does not get treated the same way as, for example, Mr. Stephen Kay, QC, and also a British gentleman. And last week, Mr. May at one point addressed the Serbian friend of the court and said to him, English is the language of this court. And one had to think, well, so is the justice, apparently.
Liliana Smilovic speaking to us from Belgrade. You are listening to Democracy Now! Zimbabwe, Bob Marley, and the Wailers. Here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, I'm Amy Goodman. In Zimbabwe, incumbent President Robert Mugabe has been declared the winner in last weekend's presidential elections. This week, the headlines in the corporate media in the U.S. and Western Europe were awash with condemnations of the elections. Headlines like Zimbabwe's stolen vote, Zimbabwe's or Mugabe's false victory, and Washington doesn't recognize Zimbabwe election results. But despite the headlines in the Western press, many of the election observers from African nations say the election result is legitimate. An observer team from the Organization of African Unity called the poll transparent, credible, free, and fair. Namibia called the election watertight, without room for rigging. And Nigerian observers said they'd seen nothing that threatened the integrity of the poll. Still, the opposition candidate, Morgan Tsvangirai, has declared the election one of the greatest frauds of modern elections. We're going to begin by speaking to Ambassador Simbi Mubako. He is Zimbabwe's ambassador to the United States, also a law professor and a frequent lecturer in the United States and around the world. This past winter, he taught a course at Williams College in Massachusetts on political history of Southern Africa. Ambassador Mubako, welcome to Democracy Now! It's good to have you with us. Can you start by responding to the West's charges? I guess President Bush talked about the elections as being flawed.
Well, the Western reaction is the reaction of the losers. In Africa itself, losers never concede defeat, as is a practice in the West. And in that fashion, the loser, Tsvangirai, did not concede defeat, and his backers, the West, also do not concede that defeat. So really, it's nothing surprising. It is just sour grapes as far as the West is concerned. They backed a loser.
We're joined on the phone as well from Harare, Zimbabwe, by Trevor Nkube, publisher of Zimbabwe's Independent. Your response to the ambassador?
Well, it's very unfortunate that the ambassador views such a grave situation the way he does, because clearly the evidence is there on the ground for everybody to see that this was never going to be a free and fair election. This is not about sour grapes. This is not about sour grapes from the West. It's not about sour grapes from the losers. It's about 2 years of a violent campaign by Robert Mugabe's regime. It's about 2 years of intimidation, murder, and mayhem, the breakdown of rule of law throughout the country by Robert Mugabe's desperate attempt to hold on to political power. Over 140 innocent Zimbabweans lost their lives through Robert Mugabe's violent campaign, his desperate efforts to hold on to political power. The evidence is there of the people that were killed and so forth. The opposition was unable to campaign in over 40% of the country. They couldn't go in the rural areas because ZANU-PF militia, assisted by the army and the police, made it difficult for the opposition to campaign in the rural areas. As everybody now knows, the ruling party, aware that the opposition has a stronghold in the urban areas, made it difficult for voters in the urban areas to go and vote freely. Efforts were made, which were very successful, to frustrate the voters in the urban areas by reducing the number of polling stations. It took on average anything between 12 hours and 22 hours for a single person to cast their vote in urban areas. This is a situation clearly which cannot be deemed to be a free and fair election. The ground was not even. Robert Mugabe was a referee, he was a fighter, he was the linesman. Everything was in his favor. And this must not be an election result that must be accepted by all Democrats throughout the world.
Ambassador Mubako, could you respond to what Trevor talked about, Trevor Nkube of the Zimbabwe Independent? Ambassador, are you there? We'll go back to Trevor Nkube then. Trevor Nkube, as you just heard in the lead, you had African countries like Namibia calling the election watertight without room for rigging, Nigerian observers saying that they had seen nothing that threatened the integrity of the poll, the Organization of African Unity calling the poll transparent, credible, free, and fair.
You know, I think the fundamental thing for all of us to realize is the fact that Africa, by its very nature, does not have a democratic culture. What is important to realize is that all these African countries that have rushed to declare this election free and fair have themselves never held free and fair election since independence from colonial rule. Kenya, for example. President Arap Moi is known to be a thug when it comes to conducting elections. Namibia, Sam Nujoma has fought his way into a third term in Namibia and is eyeing a fourth term. He's not a Democrat. He cannot be trusted to pass a verdict on any democratic election. The Nigerians, we all know, they have no idea what democracy is all about. They are just starting to get into experimenting with democracy. The other thing to remember is that the Organization of African Unity is a group of people who want all the time to be seen to be in solidarity with each other, not in solidarity with the African people who they rule over in a very brutal manner. So it's very unfortunate, I think, for the African continent that Africans have decided to side with Robert Mugabe in this brutal and very unfree election. It's really a sad indictment, a very serious indictment on Africa's chances to be taken seriously by the international community. Because if Africa cannot take itself seriously, why should it expect the whole world to take it seriously and come to the assistance.
Ambassador Simbi Mubako, the Zimbabwean ambassador to the United States. Trevor Nkube has listed a number of allegations of fraud and the fact, as you just heard, that that he was laying out that people in the cities in particular had very serious trouble voting and that the opposition had very hard time campaigning around the country. Could you respond to those charges?
Yes, I certainly can. And for the long history that Mr. Nkube has been related to you, that is what he has been writing for the past 2 years. He has been alleging all those things without giving any proof, for anything that he alleges.
Ambassador Simbi Mubako, we're just going to switch your line right now and see if we can get a better line. Go ahead. Could you repeat what you were saying?
I said for the long history that you have been given by Trevor Nkube, all I can say is that is what he has been saying for the past 3-4 years. He is known to be an enemy of the government. He is an anti-Mugabe writer. You can't take too seriously what he does allege. But what is important is that if all those allegations were true, the opposition would not have gone into the elections. They went into the elections confident that they would win, and they always said so, that they would win. Now that they have lost, they are saying that they have lost because of irregularities. I'm not saying that the elections were perfect, by no means. In fact, no elections have been perfect in many countries, including in this country, as you know, from the Florida experience last year. The only concession I would make to the allegations he has made is that the arrangements for the election in Harare, and Harare only, were not so good. Clearly, there were a few voting places that were allocated for Harare. That's why there were so many people that were queuing. But they were given an extra day. And even if there were some people who still didn't vote in that extra day, they would be very few and would not make any real difference. Even if you gave all the people that remain on the voters' roll to Tsvangirai, Mugabe would still win because all the people that remain on the voters' roll who didn't vote were about 300,000. And even if they had all turned up and all voted for Tsvangirai, which is unlikely, Mugabe would still have 100,000 votes over and above Tsvangirai. So there is no question whatever that Mugabe won a resounding victory. There's no point trying to detract from that. What is important now is that Zimbabweans must work together to refloat the economy of the country. That is what is important. Let's forget about the elections and go forward as the United Nations.
Trevor Nkube, what about the issue of land that Mugabe made the centerpiece of his campaign?
Well, first of all, the ambassador, I think, has been away from home for a long time. The voters' role, he must be told, has got about 5.2 million people. And only 3.1 Zimbabweans were able to vote in the just ended election. So if he says give the remaining to Morgan Tsvangirai, I'm sure he realizes that the mathematics is not on his side. And secondly, it's unfortunate that an ambassador like him chooses to call another Zimbabwean an enemy of the government and finds it criminal for somebody to be an anti-Mugabe. It's really pretty sad. But unfortunately, that's the kind of utterances that you expect from people that have a lot to benefit from Mugabe's continued presence. He's saying that let's forget about the elections, let's go ahead. I think if he was in Zimbabwe, he would realize that the mood is not about forgetting the elections, because forgetting the elections means forgetting the 140 plus people that ZANU-PF has murdered. the many thousands of people that ZANU-PF has displaced through its so-called fast-track land policy, the many more people that ZANU-PF has tortured, innocent women and girls that ZANU-PF militias have raped, and many more that have been injured and maimed by ZANU-PF thugs. This will not be forgotten. History will register this. And
Ambassador Mugabako, your response to that and to the issue of land.
Yes, again, Trevor is mistaken when he says I've not been to Zimbabwe for a long time. I was in Zimbabwe in December. You should know that. And I was in Zimbabwe in August. I'm very often in Zimbabwe and very much in touch with what's going on. The land question, which you have raised, I think was a very crucial reason why Mugabe won so resoundingly. There's no doubt that people in the countryside care tremendously about land redistribution, and they love Mugabe's policies because that has brought them land. The other people pretend that they like land reform, but they do nothing about it. As to the allegations of people that have died and that have been tortured and so on, of course, there are some people who have died, but the evidence of the latest election is that there have been deaths caused by both MDC as well as ZANU-PF. But what I'm saying is that in spite of that, there's no point dwelling on the past. What we must do is now to try and work together. And my view is that Mugabe, the winner, should be magnanimous enough to be able to work with the losers if they are prepared to work with him. The point of view which is being given by Trevor really leaves you with no solution. What is he proposing? Is he proposing that we should cancel the election and go to another election? You will get exactly the same result, if not even better, for Mugabe. What's the point? What is it suggesting we should do? He's not coming out with any solution. I'm suggesting that we should now work together as a government and as the people of Zimbabwe. Whether we've got differences of opinion or not, it does not mean that we should go on fighting each other.
Trevor Nkube, what are you suggesting must happen now?
Well, I mean, it's very fine and good that, after they've killed so many Zimbabweans, after giving themselves this victory, after stealing this election, they now come to the same people that they've beaten, killed and maimed and say, let's sit down and do business together. It's very hard to swallow. To a lot of Zimbabweans who are still paying by the daylight robbery that has just been conducted by ZANU-PF.
Well,
I do agree.
What is he suggesting?
I've been quiet whilst he was talking. Can he be civilized and allow me to finish what I want to say?
Trevor
and
Kube.
It's important that Zimbabweans.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Trevor Nkube.
I was saying it's important that a solution be found. That solution has to involve the international community. It has to involve Zimbabweans sitting down and say, how do we proceed? I think what happened on Saturday and Sunday and Monday is a culmination of 2 years, which cannot be easily forgotten. The solution is not easy to find. It's very easy for the winners to say that you have a solution. But all that I would say needs to be done is for people to sit around the table and discuss this issue. MDC has not accepted the results. The temptation really is to say the elections must be nullified, that lessons must be drawn here, that stolen elections will not be accepted. Because if you don't, then everybody's going to steal elections and hope that thereafter they will be magnanimous and say, let's sit around with our enemies and discuss this thing. I think it's important to draw the line and stand and say, this will not be acceptable. And what ZANU-PF has just done, simply not acceptable.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both for being with us. It is an issue we will continue to follow and particularly look at the issue of land in Zimbabwe. Our guests have been Trevor Nkube, publisher of Zimbabwe's Independent, a weekly newspaper in Harare, speaking to us from there, from the capital of Zimbabwe, and Zimbabwean ambassador to the United States, Simbi Mubako, speaking to us from the Washington area. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, Ralph Nader. Stay with us.
Maybe it's the books, maybe it's the bullets, maybe it's the real crooks, maybe it's the drugs, maybe it's the parents, maybe it's the colors everybody's wearing, maybe it's the president, maybe it's the last one, maybe it's the one before that, what he done, maybe it's the high schools, maybe it's the teachers, maybe it's the tattooed children in the bleachers, maybe it's the Bible, maybe it's the lack, maybe it's the music, maybe it's the crack, maybe it's the hairdos, maybe it's the TV, maybe it's the cigarettes, maybe it's the family, maybe it's the fast food, maybe it's the news, maybe it's divorce, maybe it's abuse, maybe it's the lawyers, maybe it's the prison, maybe it's the senators, maybe it's the system, maybe it's the fathers, maybe it's the sons, maybe it's the sisters, maybe it's the moms, maybe it's the radio, maybe it's the road rage, maybe El Nino or UV rays, maybe it's the army, maybe it's the liquor, maybe it's the papers, maybe the militia, maybe it's the athletes, maybe it's the ads, maybe it's the sports fans, maybe it's a fad, maybe it's the magazines, maybe it's the internet, maybe it's the lottery, maybe it's the immigrants, maybe it's taxes, big business, maybe it's the KKK and the skinheads, maybe it's the communists, maybe it's the Catholics, maybe it's the hippies, maybe it's the addicts, maybe it's the art, maybe it's the sex, maybe it's the homeless, maybe it's the banks.
You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate stood by the high-powered vehicles of suburbia this week and refused to impose tougher fuel economy standards. Instead, they voted overwhelmingly for a much weaker provision supported by the auto industry. We're joined by Ralph Nader. I spoke to him in our Firehouse studio yesterday afternoon to talk about issues of auto safety, fuel efficiency, Enron, anthrax, health insurance, and the war in Afghanistan. We began with this latest Senate move on the issue of the Senate rule supporting the auto industry.
Well, as we now know, the Senate defeated the proposal by Senator John Kerry and John McCain to give the auto companies another 13 years to increase their fuel efficiency to, say, a little over 35 miles per gallon. And the arguments against it, which were made by both Democrats like Senator Zell Miller and Republicans, were so absurd they could hardly be dignified with a comment. They immediately swallowed the propaganda of the auto companies, which companies tried the same thing 25 years ago, saying we couldn't build pickups, we couldn't build vans, couldn't build cars with four-door sedans. And they used the same thing, as if you can't have fuel-efficient cars and vans and pickups the way you have now. So it's the big lie. The engineers know how to improve the fuel efficiency. The industry's had 27 years since the last statutory deadline for fuel efficiency, effective in 1985, 27.5 miles per gallon for automobiles and 20 miles for SUVs and whatever they were called then. It hasn't been increased since. So basically, we're at a situation now where the fuel efficiency laws have been de facto nullified or repealed. And the only way we're going to get more fuel efficient cars is if the Japanese come in and break up this cartel of stagnant technology called Detroit.
Why is the Senate risking this? Why have they voted this down? I mean, given how people are feeling right now about Enron and other issues.
Part is the power of the automobile lobby. Part is the power of the United Auto Workers, which for some mysterious reason has always surrendered that issue to the auto giants and doesn't say, look, we almost lost half our market in the late 70s. The only thing that saved us was the fuel efficiency standards because the Japanese were coming in and the Germans were coming in eating up our market. And that's what is going to happen again. And yet those people in Solidarity House can't get it through their heads that they shouldn't just be lapdogs of the auto moguls and muscle even more Democrats into this ridiculous situation, which has this assumption is you can't have a fuel-efficient car and a safe car. You can't have a fuel-efficient car and a variety of vehicles. It's completely false. It's been demonstrated to be such by the fleet of the auto companies worldwide themselves. I mean, for instance, the safest car ever built in the world was built 25 years ago by the Department of Transportation under contract with Chrysler and the Cornell Aero Lab, and it got 31 miles on a gallon, and it was a small car by today's standards, 2,700 pounds, 3,100 pounds, and it was the safest car in the world. So it isn't a matter of weight, it's a matter of size, it's a matter of crushable space, as Clarence Ditlow, head of the Center for Auto Safety, engineer and lawyer, has been pointing out for years. So what about global warming? What about the family budget? What about air pollution on the ground? We don't care about these things, says two out of three senators, including a lot of Democrats, the other day. I mean, this is criminal ignorance. It's a level of atavism that you would not have expected of the Congress in the 1950s.
Well, speaking of energy, your latest thoughts on the latest with Enron, Arthur Andersen, Enron policy, overall energy policy.
Well, Enron is a great engine for reform. You've heard of the phrase patron saint. Enron can be the patron devil of reform. It's so big, so corrupt, so hierarchical. The big guys sold early with hundreds of millions of bucks and left the workers with depleted pension plans and collapsed the company virtually to a point where thousands were laid off. I mean, you couldn't have it any worse. No patriotism, no federal taxes paid three out of the last 4 years by this supposed super profitable corporation, ripping off the customers in California, part of the rigged system in the so-called electricity crisis, pushing for deregulation of electricity, making electricity a necessity in life, a speculative commodity instead. And now you have all the politicians now in high dungeon, half of whom took money from Enron. They're up there stomping their feet. Enron's terrible. This is terrible. Quick, the window dressing. They got seven blocks of window dressing in Washington now. One bill after another doesn't do anything really about the accounting firm's abuses. No enforcement teeth, no prosecutorial budgets. So we have a coalition, Enron Reform Coalition, and it's all elaborated on our website, citizenworks.org. That's citizenworks, one word, .org. And you'll see what some of the real proposals are. Tough corporate crime, fraud and abuse statutes are needed. Larger authorities to investors to control their runaway, greedy corporate executives. Imagine you have a capitalist system where the owners have no power. You have the corporate executives disenfranchising the investors. The stockholders doesn't have any power. They say, if you don't like the way we're running the company owners, get out, sell. So citizenworks.org, we're trying to get large numbers of people spending 5 minutes just telling their senator and representative, this is not going to blow over. It's not going to be like the savings and loan scandal when nothing happened in terms of structural reform after the taxpayer was done to $500 billion in principal and interest to bail out these crooks and speculators 10 or 11 years ago. It's not going to blow over. We want corporate reform to be the phrase that rings throughout the land, repeated a billion times, so that no politician can avoid taking a position on corporate reform, just as the way they did it with welfare reform.
We're talking to Ralph Nader in our studios here in the Firehouse. The pensions, what has to be done around the issue of pensions, 401k, and what is Bush trying to do right now?
Well, I think the 401k structure is very flawed. First of all, the rules are set by the management. Second of all, they can contribute only if the workers have enough money to save at the end of the month, which means most workers don't have enough money to save to put into their 401k to trigger the contribution, which often is the stock of the company. So I favor going back to the old type pension plans, what's called the defined benefit type plans, where whether through a unilateral decision by the management or preferably through collective bargaining with the union, there's a certain amount of money put in month after month by the employer, and on retirement, the people get so many dollars a month, just like Social Security. And under that kind of defined benefit plan, instead of the 401k, you can have early vesting, you can develop portability. The Pension Rights Center in Washington, D.C., a group I helped start years ago, has it all detailed and would love to send people who are interested information about all of these situations dealing with Enron, 401k, and defined benefit plans.
Instead, what direction is this being pushed in? The whole, when you look at the Republicans in Congress right now, and often it's the Democrats as well, how are they trying to protect themselves, to protect a kind of corporate reform juggernaut from taking off?
Well, for example, they'll say to the SEC, be a little more alert. They won't give the SEC more money. They won't appoint SEC commissioners other than those who come from the accounting and corporate community to begin with. You know, the fox guarding the chicken house. And in terms of investor rights, that isn't even on the screen in Congress. Heaven forbid giving the owners of these capitalist corporations some power to control their managers and their completely out of control executives. Pensions, there's some talk. They'll say, oh, well, you know, you can sell the company stock. The companies can't tie the hands as they did the Enron pension holders. That while the executive sold high, the people who had the Enron stock in their 401ks couldn't sell. And I watched this stock take a kamikaze dive into a few pennies per share from when it was $80 per share. So there isn't going to be much unless this coalition really catches hold. We really want you to contact citizenworks.org and just take 5 minutes. If a few million people took 5 minutes just to say to their member of Congress, we're watching you, it's not going to blow over. We want real reform, because all these members of Congress have their finger to the wind now. On the one hand, they're denouncing Enron-type scandals, which are very symptomatic of all kinds of corporations. Even conservative George Will said, the Enron scandal is a systemic problem of capitalism today. So you better believe him, Amy. If George Will says this, you better believe him. But these are the issues I tried to elaborate in the Green Party presidential campaign and are discussed in vibrant, exciting, prophetic detail in the book, Crashing the Party, that I just came out with on the campaign and a look forward to reform, especially a list on page 319 of 10 major advances which we should have accomplished years ago, and some of them accomplished in Western Europe, like universal health care, which we have got to grapple with in the next 5-10 years as a vibrant population.
On the issue of Enron and campaign contributions and what it says about the electoral system. I mean, you ran against the man who became president, whether or not he was popularly elected, very close to Ken Lay, the CEO of Enron, gave a fortune. In fact, just had to amend how much money they have spent on lobbying, campaign contributions, not clear how much Enron gave. But how does Enron teach, what does it teach us about the elections?
Well, it teaches us that
money. And do you think Ken Lay should go to jail?
Money in campaigns laid the groundwork for deregulation, which is another word for taking the federal cop off the corporate crime, fraud, and abuse beat. And Enron and others accomplished that. They weakened the security fraud laws, and they allowed futures to be traded in electricity contracts without any regulation by the Commodities Market Exchange. They got exempted from that. So they got their money's worth and more. The question is anybody going to go to jail? Well, that remains to be seen. Most corporate crooks escape, and the few that do go to jail improve their golf game in these nice, you know, corporate crime jails, like in Pennsylvania. They're almost like country clubs.
Do you think Lay should go to jail?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of them should go to jail, but to say they should go to jail, you have to A, determine that a criminal law was violated. Problem is, they made sure the laws are not violated. They made sure there isn't a criminal sanction. So I can say that he behaved in a criminal way. He participated in inflating earnings. He participated in cover-up. He deceived the pension holders. He enriched himself with insider information. But that doesn't mean there is a statute there ready to be invoked by a prosecutor. The corporate lobbyists have become very good at knocking out the criminal penalty in laws that otherwise are supposed to cover criminal behavior.
So what law would you like to see in place that involves criminal activity?
Well, I think Paul O'Neill, the Secretary of Treasury, had a good idea that the standard for convicting these executives should be negligence. So they can't go up to Congress and say, gee, I didn't know about it. You know, I just am in the boss. I struck fear in the heart of all the workers. I had all the people able to give me information. I traded on that information. Oh, I didn't know this was going on. I mean, this is, I mean, the big lie has assumed new proportions in this country. So we need an omnibus corporate criminal statute that deals with all of these outrages for years now that have been reported in Business Week and Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and other Marxist publications, you know. I mean, it's all been exposed, but nothing happens.
We last spoke after the President Bush's State of the Union address. Yeah. You said something at the very end of the program, which I wanted to follow up on, and that involved anthrax. The latest news is that the Bush administration is congratulating itself on not preventing a much larger outbreak. A guy in the CDC apparently has anthrax who was in the lab. What are your thoughts about anthrax, about the threats, and who's behind the whole anthrax attack?
Well, nobody knows for sure, except that most of the enforcement agencies think it was domestic. It did not come from the backers of the attackers on September 11th, that it might have been a deranged scientist, Unabomber-type person with access to national laboratories or military laboratories like Fort Detrick. And the local television station in Washington during the sweeps period had a very powerful investigation of Fort Detrick, and they had one of the former people working there on the TV saying, we produced 1,400 pounds of anthrax a month. And basically it's adding that it was very easy to take it out, take some of it out. There was not much security at all. Now, if you've got that kind of condition at the various installations around the country, which used hundreds of millions of dollars over the years for chemical and biological warfare, it's a wonder it hasn't happened more frequently. Not that it just happened once. And I might say the anthrax problem scared far more Americans outside of New York City and Washington than the attack on September 11th. Everyone who opened the letter, for heaven's sake, for example, or was concerned about a child being exposed to something that might be in a letter that was just detergent powder or cosmetic powder. And Bush is not spending much time on this. He's very much extroverted to the foreign terrorists, but by far a much more difficult to control source of mindless terror can well be this kind of model that was behind the anthrax letters.
In fact, as you mentioned, didn't mention anthrax in the State of the Union address, though spent a good portion of his time talking about the bombing of Afghanistan and getting the terrorists. Do you think it has something to do with it? It may well be, as you're saying, Unabomber type, Timothy McVeigh type, white militia type, or someone who you can't stereotype and vilify and bomb a country for, unless you're going to bomb this one.
Well, it is harder to anthropomorphize, for example. I mean, Bush is a West Texas sheriff, and he happens to be in the White House. And, you know, can you imagine sending the Army, Navy, and Marines after these bad guys in some foreign country where they can blow hundreds of square miles into smithereens and get higher poles back home? What do you do with the domestic anthrax people? What do you do? Who do you send? What are the leads? It's not dramatic. It's maybe very embarrassing in terms of his own government's lax security problems. If, for example, under his watch, the labs leaked this sort of stuff, who's he going to blame? He's going to blame the communists? Is he going to blame the foreign terrorists? So there's a natural inclination to turn your back on this. Although I can tell you that a lot of people in the government are worried sick over this. But it's not getting into the headlines.
It's actually a very interesting lesson. And that is, here you have this situation, and no one would suggest that this some city here should be bombed if it turns out that that's where the anthrax came from. And yet that's exactly the approach when it comes to the bombing of Afghanistan, that something happens, and it's believed that the people who did this are from there, so you bomb the country.
Well, you burn down the haystack in order to find some needles, which they haven't found yet, but they have burned down the haystack. It's total chaos now. I mean, there's a repressive dictatorship, obviously, but now 99% of Afghanistan is controlled by the warlords, and more news reports are coming out that there's chaos, violence, brutality, competition between them, the worst conditions And it's the old rogues replacing the new rogues, and then there'll be new rogues replacing the old rogues. And now they have some of our military equipment. And so what have we really accomplished? There were, you know, military strategists usually have different options that they discuss with one another. But in this country, we were told to keep quiet, get in line, support the president, and not give the government any inputs. When the government doesn't have many inputs, they're going to make mistakes and blunders, and they're not going to be very resistant to the autocratic ideologues restricting our civil liberties, like John Ashcroft and his supporters, or the commercial militarists who are going for huge multi-billion dollar weapon systems that were designed for a Soviet Union era of hostility, or the corporate welfare lobbies demanding, subsidies, handouts, giveaways, all saying it's 9/11. So you have these three very, very anti-American, unpatriotic forces gaining steam in Washington and pushing aside all these domestic concerns that affect tens of millions of people, from living wage to health insurance to toxic pollution control, to economic conversion policies, you name it. What's happened, what we've done to ourselves after 9/11 is of immense consequence if we don't look up to, wake up to it.
We're talking to Ralph Nader. He's come off the presidential campaign and has written a book about his experience. It's called Crashing the Party, How to Tell the Truth and Still Run for President. We'll be back with him in a minute.
Life is short, and if you're looking for extension, with your time, you had best do well. 'Cause there's good deeds and there's good intention. There's far apart.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. We're talking to Ralph Nader, who's certainly one. And he has written the book Crashing the Party, How to Tell the Truth and Still Run for President. Do you think it's fair to say right now that a man who is not popularly elected president has declared war on the world?
That's a sweeping statement. Clearly, he lost the popular vote. Clearly, it was a political decision by the Supreme Court. 5-4 was the vote count. He doesn't have that kind of mandate. But even if he was elected, but popularly, even if he won the electoral vote, why is our president constantly exerting military action or talking about military action without ever mentioning the legal basis for it? You see, what's happening is he's basically saying to the violent forces abroad that we're going to match you violence for violence, and we're going to go into any country that we want, never mind national boundaries, national jurisdictions, international law. And once our country stands for that, we're going to lose whatever moral credibility, whatever popular support, whatever legitimacy, whatever kind of perspectives that people like to direct toward us as a deliberate force for justice, and we'll be in the pits with the most violent, lawless elements. Now, who's going to win? We've got far more to lose as a nation. We're far more vulnerable. They don't care what they lose. They're suicide. They're willing to commit suicide. We may be the most powerful country in the world, but we're the most vulnerable, too, in terms of our industry and the objects of attack. And everybody knows that. It's no secret. So why didn't he say, I hereby invoke the international law doctrine of hot pursuit. Under certain UN treaties or principles, our government has a right to do this. Or we don't have a right to do that. Instead, he's behaving, again, like a West Texas sheriff who thinks that he can do whatever he wants because he has more planes and tanks than the other guys.
Do you think that the U.S. should have bombed Afghanistan?
No.
What do you think should have happened?
They should have invoked the law of hot pursuit, developed a multilateral commando force, including people who know the languages and the customs over there, used bribes and spies, and focused with good intelligence on the backers of the attackers. Thousands of people of all ages and innocence have died in Afghanistan directly from the bombing and from the refugee camps and the TB and the starvation. And what was their role in this? What we're doing is turning Afghanistan into an even more chaotic situation, and that produces what Chalmers Johnson, who I'm sure you've interviewed, called blowback. Unintended consequences that boomerang on us and on a lot of innocent people abroad.
What do you think of the COG, the continuity of government, the shadow government that's now in where Virginia and Pennsylvania, wherever of 100 top-level people, apparently Dick Cheney's been spending a lot of his time there. We've been wondering where he is, in these secret locations running a shadow government?
Well, first of all, Dick Cheney and his undisclosed locations, three of them were fundraisers. One in Texas, one in Oklahoma, and one in Washington, D.C. I guess that's part of his definition of an undisclosed
what do you
location.
Mean?
Yeah, you know, when they said, where's Dick Cheney? And they would say, undisclosed location. Well, three times he was at fundraisers. So so a shadow. You do need that kind of precaution. It's unfortunately a very chaotic world. And I think it's prudent to have a reservoir of government officialdom that can move in case there is a catastrophe. But that doesn't mean you don't let Congress know about it, that it's unaccountable. We don't know what it is. We don't know what kind of authority. You can still have it as an alternative and still give it some sort of visibility in terms of where the authority comes from, what the function should be, under what conditions. And we have a constitutional amendment that says under certain conditions, if the president is disabled, then the vice president moves in. If that's the case, then you have the succession. They have none of that. It was a typical Bush operation.
We're talking to Ralph Nader about a number of issues. His book is Crashing the Party, How to Tell the Truth and Still Run for President. Not getting much corporate media attention these days. Not certainly in the New York Times, though. I saw you on the bestseller list a while ago. That's when you get mentioned in the New York Times. I wanted to go back, though, and see if this was a media issue or a decision you made. We talked to you soon after the election, and you got a lot of attention at the end of the election. When Florida was being disputed. And a lot of people wondered where you were at that time, that you had challenged every aspect of the election until then. And here at this pivotal moment of weeks when the election was up for grabs, when we learned that hundreds of thousands of particularly African Americans were disenfranchised, where were you, for example, in the streets of Florida?
Well, first I was on page one of the Rochester, New York paper because I had a press conference, and one of many in that period, where the reporters actually came and reported my comments on the Florida situation. I was available for comment, but a lot of the press is either Republican and Democrat, and the Republicans don't care about these things because, for obvious reasons. But the Democrats, they didn't like the Green Party. They thought we cost Gore the election, never mind losing Tennessee or Arkansas or whatever.
But, for example, Gore went after Jackson, told him not to go take to the streets. Very puzzling why in Florida. But you weren't there to be told that.
Well, Jackson actually did have a couple demonstrations.
Yeah, he tried, but then he left.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I don't like that sort of, everybody has their taste. I mean, we didn't know any facts at the time, except that something was wrong. I don't like to speculate. I don't like to shoot my mouth off and then find out that I was wrong. So what I did was I criticized the apparatus generally. speaking, like the lack of a change of address notification for precincts and what they did on the felons in the prison and the mix-up there. But
which turned out wasn't a mix-up. They deliberately purged the voter polls by tens of thousands.
And then there's a lot of work to be done in the meantime. I mean, who minds the store, so to speak? I mean, who works on these less flamboyant issues that continue? I mean, auto safety, that's really dull, you know? I mean, 125,000 Americans have died since September 11th under preventable conditions in the workplace, from air pollution, on the highway, and in medical malpractice situations in hospitals. I mean, who works on that, right? So,
but on that issue, what do you think? Are the have any safeguards been put in place right now to guarantee that this doesn't happen again?
Some will go into effect just because there are civil rights groups locally that will be much more alert. It's really interesting how people are alert to discrimination patterns, but not to the machinery of the election, even though a lot of people knew about it. They just didn't focus on it. We all knew what goes on in Chicago, how votes get lost and deceased people vote and so on. But they didn't know how subtle and varied the techniques were and how broadly distributed from New Mexico and Florida and elsewhere around the country. Maybe now they'll be more alert. That's number one. They won't be able to pull fast ones, the officials. That's one. And then the second is there's a bill about to go through Congress that, while it's not what I would like completely, it doesn't federalize standards for federal elections. It leaves it up to the states. Federal elections, can you imagine? But it will improve and provide more money to rationalize the process.
Will you run again?
Too early to say.
Mm-hmm. The steelworkers and the tariff that President Bush has put in place. What do you think of the politics of this, and can you explain it to our listeners?
Well, the steel companies, about 80% of them have modernized, and they're very competitive in terms of hours per ton of steel. And new companies have come forward, very, very efficient companies. But you can't compete with Chinese steel and Russian steel, where they pay 30 cents an hour, 20 cents an hour with brand new equipment, and they work just as hard as our steel workers. And Bush did the right thing for the wrong reason. He put on a 30% tariff for 3 years, over 3 years. But he did it because he wants to win Pennsylvania, and he wants to win these key states that he very narrowly won or lost. And he's taking a lot of heat abroad. But the basic question is, do we want a steel industry in the United States? And if we want a steel industry in the United States, we will push them in a variety of ways to modernize and be efficient. But no matter how efficient, you can't compete with 30 cents an hour. I mean, what if Texas paid 30 cents an hour to steel workers and they had the same equipment that Pennsylvania had, who are paying $20, $25 an hour? Where would the steel companies go?
Well, you've just made the argument, or I should say Bush has made the argument, for protective tariffs, protecting local industry, something that the administration and the one before him, which was Democrat, have been fighting in other countries every step of the way, people trying to protect their own industries.
Exactly. He's lost some credibility, and it's good, because he's basically said, well, it is whose ox is gored. He's been lording it over the other countries. Now he got some of his own medicine, and he became more protective.
Ralph Nader, Crashing the Party, How to Tell the Truth and Still Run for President, is the name of his latest book. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, Jeremy Scahill, Chris Abrams. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. Our email address is mail@democracynow.org, mail@democracynow.org. You can get a cassette copy of today's show by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Maybe it's the books, maybe it's the bullets, maybe it's the real crooks, maybe it's the drugs, maybe it's the parents, maybe it's the colors everybody's wearing, maybe it's the president, maybe it's the last one, maybe it's the one before that, what he done, maybe it's the high schools, maybe it's the teachers, maybe it's the tattooed children in the bleachers, maybe it's the Bible, maybe it's the lack, maybe it's the music, maybe it's the crack, maybe it's the hairdos, maybe it's the TV, maybe it's the cigarettes, maybe it's the family, maybe it's the fast food, maybe it's the news, maybe it's divorce, maybe it's abuse, maybe it's the lawyers, maybe it's the prison, maybe it's the senators, maybe it's the system, maybe it's the fathers, maybe it's the sons, maybe it's the sisters, maybe it's the moms, maybe it's the radio, maybe it's the road rage, maybe El Nino or UV rays, maybe it's the army, maybe it's the liquor, maybe it's the papers, maybe the militia, maybe it's the athletes, maybe it's the ads, maybe it's the sports fans, maybe it's a fad, maybe it's the magazines, maybe it's the internet, maybe it's the lottery, maybe it's the immigrants, maybe it's taxes, big business, maybe it's a KKK.